Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today, we continue our series on death and dying by discussing end-of-life affairs. Next week, we'll discuss the financial aspects of the end of life. Today, we'll discuss how to begin the conversations with loved ones and your doctor. A 2018 survey conducted by the Conversation Project found that although 92% of people in the U.S. say it's important to discuss their end-of-life care wishes, only 32% have had this conversation. This is likely why less than one-third of U.S. adults have advanced care directives in place. Many adults, regardless of background, find it very difficult to discuss their wishes for their last phase of life. In some cases, loved ones or children don't want to talk about end-of-life issues. But it is so important to have these discussions to ensure your wishes will be honored and to ease the burden of loss and grief on your loved ones. Today's guest, Dr. Vijay Perry Coyle and her colleagues started the Stanford Letter Project in 2015 to make having these discussions a bit easier. The Stanford Letter Project is based on many years of research and discussions with people from various cultural and social backgrounds. The project provides free letter templates in multiple languages. The What Matters Most letter allows you to document what treatments you want in the future. The Who Matters Most letter focuses on remembering treasured moments in life, apologizing to those you may have hurt, forgiving those who may have hurt you, and saying thank you, I love you, and goodbye. I Matter Too allows you to make a bucket list of reflections on your values and your goals. Here is a compilation of people talking about the letters they read and the letters they wrote.
Obviously, it's a comfort to know what he wants, and so that we aren't burdened with not knowing what to do in his last moments.
One of the worst things in the world that you can have happen to you is being on your deathbed and you're putting the burden of life-altering decisions on a family member that has no clue of what you really want or don't want.
If I'm brain dead, unplug me, and I want to die painless. No pain. Just put me to sleep and don't let me wake up.
You want to be buried or you want to be cremated?
I want to be cremated.
We don't like to talk about things like that. Just put everything there in writing with them. They take care of everything.
You have a brief discussion once every 10, 20 years. Who's going to remember that? So it's good that I can clearly say that, you know, save me if you can, but if you can't, save someone else.
We feel important about this because we are asked about what's our opinion and what's our idea, how we want to die. Sometimes we don't want to talk about it because nobody wants to die. But that's the only thing that's for sure, it's very certain that we will die.
That is a compilation of people talking about the letters that they read and they wrote thanks to the Stanford Letter Project. Joining us to talk about the project and end-of-life issues is Dr. Vijay Perry Coyle, a geriatric and hospice physician. Dr. Perry Coyle is professor of medicine at Stanford University's School of Medicine and founder and director of Stanford's Longevity, Equity, and Aging Research Consortium, which seeks to advance longevity and prosperity for all. She's also founder of the Stanford Letter Project and principal investigator of a large grant from the state of California to advance multicultural aging. Dr. Vijay Perry Coyle has won many awards for her research, including the 2025 Richard Payne Outstanding Achievement in Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion. Hi, Dr. Perry Coyle. Thank you so much for your important work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for the kind introduction, and thanks for having me.
Well, this is such an important project. You have many years of experience in geriatric and hospice care. You have been at the bedside of many patients who were about to die. Can you first tell us how you got involved in this work?
It is something of a passion for me. We always focus on patients' health and well-being and what their wishes are when they are younger. But as people get older, their voices get more and more silenced. And in my experience, you know, my older patients have such brilliant life plans. They have such vitality and they want to always, you know, engage their family. They are so sociable. And so in having these one-on-one conversations when I was training at Stanford, at the bedside, you know, when you're on call and it's late in the night and you're sitting and you have a conversation with the patient and then it turns out to be this amazing conversation and you learn about their lives. And that's how it all got started for me. One of my patients was very reticent when family was there. I was taking care of him. He was in the nursing home in our palliative care unit, and he was in the last phase of his life, and he would talk about his wife and his son and kids with such love, you know, say like really sort of very poignant things and very, you know, for a want of a better word, very lovey-dovey, wonderful things about how much he loved his wife and how important this was. And then when they came to visit him, complete silence, like vast silence. So I would tell them, you know, your husband talked about this and I heard this and I understood this about you and you make this amazing thing and you had this wonderful. She's like, no, that's not my husband. He doesn't talk. So it almost became like, you know, you're making stuff up. And so I just took one of my like family cameras and recorded him while he was speaking with me, with his permission, of course. And then when they came, I played the recording to them. And they were like, they just couldn't believe it, that this was her husband, this reticent sort of stoic man. And so that is how this started. And the way he talked about it was almost like a letter. And so we worked with patients to figure out, you know, how can we make this threatening topic less threatening? Why is it we have such a hard time saying, you know, I love you to the people we love? And so that is how it started.
Wow, that's an amazing story. Can you talk about why these conversations are so difficult? I love the woman in the clip that we played who said, it is very certain that we will die. This is just something that's going to happen, and we all know it. And yet these conversations are still so difficult to have. Why is that, based on all of the experience you have talking to so many patients?
I'll give you a couple of thoughts, and then later on, you know, you might, I would love to hear your feedback and other callers as well. I think fundamentally, we just have difficulty opening up. All of us do, and I'm talking about myself more so than anyone else. I was looking up at, you know, reading research, and Robin Dunbar, who's a British anthropologist, talks about how most people have a maximum of about 150 social connections that are meaningful, and most people have about only like 5 people that they are close to. So just think about it. We only have 5 people we are close to. There are only 150 meaningful connections. I'm not talking about people on social media where we click like and we repost, you know, that is something completely different. So for when you have only 5 people that you're close to, and you may not see them as often as you want to, and when you see them, you're going to want to talk about quote unquote pleasant things. And so death is the last thing that people want to talk about. And that is how this topic becomes such a taboo topic, right? And a lot of times, you know, people feel like talking about death is speaking it into existence. And that like you're almost invoking death, right? And there is that fear. So that is why I think people avoid it. I mean, if you ask me, you know, do I want to be talking about death or ice cream? My choice is always going to be ice cream. So then the question is, what is the need to do this? And why is it important? And so I don't know if that answers your question, but I'll stop there.
No, it definitely does. And Dr. Perry Coyle, the reason why we're doing this series is because I sadly lost my dad a few months ago to a rare and aggressive form of prostate cancer, small cell prostate cancer. And he was diagnosed in May and passed in early January. So it happened very quickly. And it just made me realize that we don't talk about these issues enough, because I was in it, living it. And this is not the first time that I took care of parents. And doing this show, you know, we talk about politics and social issues and everything that's happening right now. And after I went through this experience, I thought, you know, these issues are so important. And I just feel like in the day-to-day, in your media diet, whatever you listen to, the radio, read magazines, it's just not discussed enough. And I think this is so important because, I mean, you know this. The U.S. population is the oldest it's ever been. The number of Americans ages 65 and older is projected to rise from about 58 million now to 82 million by 2050. And we've also been doing a lot of shows about cancer and chronic disease. Unfortunately, the rates are on the rise. And we're all going to deal with this. And it's just so much better to be prepared so you can actually take the time that you need to grieve, because it's really hard to grieve and to try to figure out, what does my dad want? What does he want as his remembrance event? Does he want a somber celebration? Does he want a celebration at all? Does he want a party? I mean, just all of these things are so hard to deal with when you're also grieving.
First of all, my condolences to you. That is just so awful to lose a loved one, a parent like that. And the small cell prostate cancer is a particularly aggressive version of prostate cancer, because a lot of people, you know, if you look at older adults, many, many patients will actually die with prostate cancer more than they die of prostate cancer. I think one of the exceptions is the small cell prostate cancer, and the survival, as you know, is much lower. It tends to be treatment resistant. And so I'm just so sorry that you had that experience.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I feel like these shows have really helped. I mean, the first, you know, when I went back on the air, it was hard to even keep it together, actually, on many shows. But these shows have just helped a lot in honor of my dad, but also just hearing from so many of our listeners who are sharing stories about their loved ones themselves. I mean, we have people writing who say, I don't have children. I don't have a partner. I don't have many family. Who's going to help me when I reach the end of life? So I think that these people want to have these conversations. And that's just been really heartwarming and just so, so helpful.
First of all, it is so wonderful that you're honoring your dear father this way. And in my experience, having taken care of so many patients, relationships with our loved ones don't stop with death. The relationship just alters. And so there is still this really loving, lively relationship that you have with your dad, with your late dad. And through that, through him, you're now helping so many people. Mm-hmm. So that's something to just take, you know, a lot of pride in. And it's a wonderful gift that you're giving him, and not only him, you're giving it to the rest of the listeners and all of us. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
In terms of, you know, just to put a spin of, you know, show a ray of optimism here, people often worry about, oh my gosh, what happens? I don't have any loved ones. I don't have children. I've taken care of so many people who are alone, people who have been homeless, people who are estranged from their kids. And loneliness is something that we actually really study in my lab. And it always ends okay. It may not be your ideal of what you're looking for yourself, but there is always a healthcare team, someone like me. I've sat at the bedside of so many patients when they were alone. And we talk about wonderful things that, you know, they have done in their life. It doesn't matter. You know, every human being is just so unique and so amazing. They've all done some wonderful things. Of course, there are situations where people have done things that they regret. And I've sat in the bedside of that as well, where people have talked about, you know, great things that they regret and small things that they regret. But it all ends well. I think there is a book that I believe it's the Tibetan Book of Death, where one of the quotes is, don't worry, we'll all die successfully anyways. So the reason I say that is, you may at this point, and you've expressed some regret. I don't think that this is not arithmetic. There is no right or wrong way to do it. It's great to prepare. It's great to give it our best shot, just like we would for every other important thing in our life. And whatever happens is okay. And we learn from it, we teach others from it, and you did the best you could. Everyone tries, and that's okay. So it's all going to end well. And I'm just saying that as a ray of optimism. I don't want people to feel like this is a knife hanging over their head, and if one misstep, and it's going to come and hurt them and their family. No, let's move away from that. Let's go towards how can we live as long and as well as we can prepare as best we can, and then things will happen, and that's okay.
Well, that's a beautiful way to put it. And I'd love to give out the phone number if you have any questions or comments for Dr. Vijay Perry-Coyle about end-of-life issues. Today we're discussing end-of-life affairs. We'll talk about the financial aspects next week. A number of people have written in about that. Today we're just talking about how to begin the discussions with loved ones, with your doctor. What are your thoughts on this? Have you had these conversations? If you haven't, the Stanford Letter Project is a really great place to start. They provide free letter templates in multiple languages. The What Matters Most letter allows you to document what treatments you want in the future. The Who Matters Most letter focuses on remembering treasured moments in your life, maybe apologizing to people you may have hurt, forgiving those who have hurt you, and telling people, thank you, I love you, and ultimately goodbye. And it's really a beautiful project. You can learn more about it at kalw.org, click news, and then your call. Dr. Vijay Perry-Coyle is professor of medicine at Stanford University School of Medicine, founder and director of Stanford's Longevity, Equity, and Aging Research Consortium, and founder of the Stanford Letter Project. She just won an award, the 2025 Richard Payne Outstanding Achievement in Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Award. Going back to the Stanford Letter Project, I understand that you and your colleagues started this project in 2015, and it was based on many, many years of research and discussions with people from various cultural and social backgrounds. Can you tell us more about that research and what you found?
Oh, for sure. You mentioned the three types of letters, right? Like the What Matters Most, the Who Matters Most, and the I Matter Too. We really wanted to start with the Who Matters Most, because once you know who the most important pivotal people are, I call them my bedrock people, who the bedrock people in your lives are. And as I said earlier, it typically tends to be about five people. If you have 10, then my God, you're brilliant. So I think five is a good enough number for me, and I'll stick with that. And so what we did was after the story I was telling you earlier about a patient of mine where his wife and son did not know how deeply he cared, we decided to just take it out to the community. We went into the community, went in with medical interpreters and talked with people in their preferred language and said, you know, how do you do this? What do you have these conversations? And we typically heard mainly older adults with adult children saying, oh, you cannot imagine how many times I try to bring this up with my son or daughter and daughter-in-law or son-in-law, whatever. And they'll always say, oh, no, mom, please don't. Let's not have a downer conversation. We are all together for Thanksgiving, and we just want to talk about nice stuff, good stuff, uplifting stuff. And so that was creating a lot of stress for these patients because they had all these thoughts that they want to convey. And a lot of times it's not just about, you know, death, you know, heart stops, lung stops, all that is good. But they also want to talk about, oh, you know, here's what I would like to have. My mom did this when she was dying. She handed off this ring that has been in our family for 200 years, and I want to hand it off to your daughter. I mean, they want to have those conversations also. Mm. It's not about clinical. It's not just about medical. And so the patients were struggling with that. So when we went into the community, so we said, okay, what is your solution? Because if I came up with a solution, it's always, you know, here's the antibiotic, take it 3 times, 7 days, come back and see me kind of solutions. So we said, okay, what do you think we should do? How do we do this? And they said, why not make it into a simple letter? So I said, okay, great idea. Help me design it. And then letter to whom? So they said, well, typically it's a letter to your healthcare team, to your doctor, letter to your family. And then some people said, well, what about myself, what I want, looking back into my life? And when people hear the word bucket list, so we actually did a study on that, and we looked at, you know, what are the common things on a bucket list? And that feels like it's really aspirational. It's really hard to do. But a bucket list can be, I'm going to get up every morning and have breakfast. I am, like, simple but really important, key, meaningful things can go on that bucket list. And all of this was learned from the patients in the community. So that's the first step, and that's how we created this template, which we then, of course, tested and did all the usual stuff that we do, right? The randomized clinical trials and this and that, and write in journals. And so we did all that part. But the fun part was talking to the patients and learning from them.
What was it like in the beginning when the project started in 2015? How did you find people to take part in writing these letters, and how did people initially respond?
So three of my medical students were really interested in palliative care, and they wanted to do a project in the Stanford bone marrow transplant unit. So that's where we started. And what we did was we took this Stanford letter, and then the exercise was, how well do our closest ones know us? So we said, okay, let's test that. So we had the patient and their closest loved one that they, you know, whoever they identified, came into the hospital, sat down next to each other. And so we had the patient write a letter to the doctor by themselves, you know, talking about their preferences. You know, what do I want? What are the most important things to me? Do I want to be on a ventilator? What is it that you want? So they wrote it. The loved one was sitting right next to them, but blinded to each other, so they couldn't talk. And the loved one wrote a letter on behalf of the patient. And this is an extremely important point. Making decisions for ourselves is one thing, but making decisions on behalf of someone we love. So you literally have to suspend your ego, your will, your thinking, almost like metaphorically take off your head, put on their head, and think like them. Otherwise, you're making decisions for them that they may not want. So that's what we did. They sat next to each other and wrote two letters. The patient wrote for themselves, the loved one wrote on behalf of the patient. And then after they were done, they unmasked, and then they exchanged the letters with each other. Mm-hmm. And when they read each other's letter, that was their aha moment. Before they started, they swore that they were so psychologically close to each other. They knew exactly what the other person wanted. What was this exercise? It was a waste of time, etc. We said, yeah, please humor me. Just a little bit of your time. And then when they unmasked, they were shocked. They were like, what? You want this? I thought you never wanted to be on the ventilator. Oh, I thought after Dad had the thing with dialysis, you never wanted that. And then that was kind of a little bit of a, how do I say it? Like a shocking awakening for both of them. And then what we had them do was, okay, why don't you sit together now and write a collaborative letter on what the patient wants? And what we noticed was in that collab, and this is the study that we did, which we published subsequently. So in the collaborative letter, we found that the loved ones moved closer to the patients. What I mean is the patient would have a choice, the loved one would have a completely different choice. But after the discussion, the loved one would then say, okay, I hear you, I'm willing to do what you want. And so they moved to the closer to the patient, and then the final letter is what the patient signed and listed the loved one as their surrogate decision maker. Because if somebody is going to do exactly what they want for themselves and not what you want for yourself, then why even bother, right?
Right.
So that is how that happened. So let me pause there and see if that is helpful.
Very helpful. And in one of the videos I watched, a husband and wife actually had different views about what they wanted in terms of a burial or cremation. And they were talking about how they disagreed.
This is me. I have a hard time ordering coffee for my family. If they want, you know, like oat milk or regular milk and macchiato and a shot of caramel and cortada, it's like I can barely order coffee for loved ones because they're going to change their mind. How am I going to know what they want for their life preferences if I don't have one or many more conversations with them? Mm. Just think about it. Or just think about a birthday gift that you're trying to give for someone, you know, a friend, let's say a close friend. You go on some online store or you're looking at something and then you're thinking about it and you're like, oh, will they like it? Won't they like it? Will this fit? Will it not fit? It's not easy, right? Gift giving is so hard. If not knowing exactly what your loved one or someone you care about wants for their birthday, how, or if you can't order coffee exactly the way they want so that they are 100% satisfied, how can you make bigger, large dimensional decisions without talking to them, right? So that's where that came from. I had written about this in many years ago based on my experience in the in that op-ed, as an op-ed in the New York Times, where I talked about the three, I don't know if you're interested, I'll just say this and you can decide whether it's of interest to you and your listeners. There are three things that, it's called pitfalls for proxies. And there are three things that operate when we are making decisions for others. One is the call of love. The second one is the call of duty. And the third one is the call of redemption. And these three things can really mislead us as we are trying to make decisions for our loved ones. I'll stop there. You may or may not want me to go. I'm a professor. I could talk for hours. So I'll, stop.
You're great, Dr. Vijay. We actually have to take a quick break, but I do want to play another clip. Today, we are talking about end-of-life affairs, and these are difficult conversations to have, but so important. The Stanford Letter Project makes having these discussions a bit easier. They provide free letter templates in multiple languages. There's the Who Matters Most letter, the What Matters Most letter, and the I Matter Too letter. So let's hear a clip. This is a compilation of people talking about the letters they wrote to their loved ones.
I encourage everyone to write a letter like this when they are still capable of doing so, because the worst thing in our life is to regret. So at this moment, I want to tell my wife, my sons, my friends, I love you. I value every moment I have spent with you. Thank you so much.
I have worked with a lot of people. And they're all the same. We all need the same kindness, the same love. Because that's what keeps us going.
To Eddie, my husband, I love you for being my friend, my honey, my lover. Love you for taking very good care of me and for allowing me to be me.
You know I believe in angels. So be prepared. I'm coming back. I'm going to be with you. It might be a thought. It might be a hummingbird. But I'll be there. Bye.
And it's very important to write this letter because you never know when your time's up. Write this letter so they may know that you love them and you are able to say it before you're gone.
And that is the clip from the Stanford Letter Project. This project is based on many years of research and discussions with people from various cultural and social backgrounds. They provide free letter templates in multiple languages to begin end-of-life conversations with your loved ones and your doctor. And today we are joined by Dr. Vijay Perry Coyle, who is founder of the Stanford Letter Project. She's also professor of medicine at Stanford University and director of Stanford's Longevity, Equity, and Aging Research Consortium. You can join us if you have a question or a comment about end-of-life affairs. Today we're talking more about the discussions that you would like to have with loved ones and your doctor. And then next week, we'll talk more about the financial aspects. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Tomorrow, we'll continue our series on cancer and chronic disease by hearing inspiring stories from people whose health dramatically improved after eating a plant-based or predominantly plant-based diet. Prior to eating this way, these people were dealing with a number of health issues, but they dramatically improved their overall health. We thought that after doing so many shows about how the cancer rates and chronic disease rates are increasing in this country, we wanted to also talk about inspiring stories. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can email yourcall at kalw.org. If you'd like to join today's conversation, we're talking about how to best discuss end-of-life affairs with your loved ones and your doctor. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall at kalw.org. And if you'd like to learn more about the Stanford Letter Project, You can find links at kalw.org, click news, and then your call. Today we're joined by Dr. Vijay Pericoyle, professor of medicine at Stanford University. She directs Stanford's Longevity, Equity, and Aging Research Consortium and is founder of the Stanford Letter Project. Let's hear from a few callers. Let's go to John in Berkeley. Hi, John. Thank you for holding.
Oh, thank you, Rose. And thank you, Vijay, for your great work. And I am a philosopher, and so I think, first of all, it's a fear of death. Mm-hmm. It's very profound. This underlies a lot of this. But I went to UC Law School and took the courses in trust and estates and community property and taxation and property. And before I graduated, I created a set of templates. The same thing, the next step from the letters is a set of templates that one is a power of attorney for healthcare, where you set out exactly what you want done, instruct the doctors. A second is a will and testament that says exactly what you want done, and it's signed, it's the boilerplate, you just change the names, and notarized, and then the people, when the loved one dies, it's all set. And even if you don't have a lawyer, it's all done. You don't have to deal with any of that. It's all there, signed, sealed, and delivered. And you are free to grieve and find somebody who's not, who knows the person, but, you know, went to law school and can just facilitate it. You just file the papers. But the template to go with the letters, the legal template, power of attorney for health care, last will and testament.
Right. This is so important, John. Thank you for the call. We're going to specifically talk about financial issues next week, because this is, as you say, it can take so much time. It can be really difficult. My dad's friend passed away about a year before he did, his neighbor. And they didn't have a will. And they had, I think, 3 or 4 kids. The house went into probate. It was a nightmare. It was a mess. One of my dad's friends who lost her husband in a horrible accident that was not expected when he was young said it was really hard just to get his car in her name. So things that you just don't even think about. I got an email from a listener last week who said that when her parent died, she had a very difficult time getting Apple to share passwords. And she actually went to 7 on your side to push Apple to give her the passwords. So Dr. Vijay, there are so many issues. I think a lot about, you know, what we'd had to deal. I mean, my dad's various bills, his subscriptions. There's so many things now that we didn't have to deal with even 10, 15 years ago. And while these discussions are hard, it's important to have them because, as John said, it really does allow you the time to grieve rather than having to figure all of this out at the same time.
So true. So true. When you think about, there is a financial aspect of it before a person dies, and then there is an aspect of it after the person dies, right? So most of the legal paperwork, all of that takes care of or is focused on what happens, you know, what do you do with the property? How does, you know, and finding the Apple password, that's a whole nother thing, right? People have bank accounts in places that you don't even know. They have a 401ks, right? Where they worked for 3 years, 25 years ago, and that's sitting there and it was never rolled over and no one knows about it. And so those are all, you know, gathering a list of assets and getting it all in one place and then being able to access it and distribute it the way the loved one wants. That's a whole another issue. I will add another layer of complexity here, and then we won't talk about it after that. Just think about the increase in patients with cognitive impairment with this huge, it's like almost like a little silent epidemic in the country as people are getting older, dementia, right? Mm. Huge issue. And so a person might be alive, but they may have lost their ability to be decisional. And that's something that we struggle with all the time. Mm. So just think about the property after their life. Okay, fine. Let's put that in the parking lot because we're going to talk about that next week. But think about what happens, the financial, the emotional toll that happens before the person passes. If you don't quite know what they want, if you don't have it documented, and if you end up giving or trying treatments that they would never have wanted for themselves, in the meantime, that's going to cost a lot of money. So I want to be very clear in saying that my work is on longevity. I want people to live as long as they want, as well as they want. And that's what I want for myself. But I also don't want to burden my family, and I don't want to prolong the dying process. So when it is my time, I want to go peacefully and quietly with dignity, and I don't want to burden my family, right? So if you don't have these discussions, if you don't know what your loved ones want, now then you're throwing the kitchen sink at them. You're trying to do everything possible as a way of showing your love or showing that you're a dutiful daughter or son. And it is well known that in this country that personal health is one of the issues. Like healthcare costs is one of the very common causes for personal bankruptcy. So we have to think about the financial toll of not knowing, right? And the emotional toll of not knowing. So let me pause there.
Well, and then what happens if these issues are not taken care of and the family disagrees? That's also really difficult. Whereas if you have it on paper, maybe I disagree with that, but that's what mom or dad wanted, and I have to respect their wishes.
That is exactly right. That is exactly right. Having something written, especially the advance directive form, which is the Stanford letter form, is the first step in really fleshing out what patients want, what matters most to them. And then it is really important to have the physician's order for life-sustaining treatment, because that is where you discuss this with your doctor. Then I sign, the patient signs. We also list who their preferred decision maker is. And that makes it, that gives it a little bit more muscle, where you and your doctor have had this discussion and you've signed it together. So I would recommend doing the POLST form as well. Mm. The POLST is the physician's order for life-sustaining treatment form, which is a portable legal document that was originally started in Oregon, and then it's really well used in California, and it's valid across the country in many, many, many states.
Well, thank you again for the call, John. And again, we are going to talk about financial issues and end-of-life decisions next week. Let's go next to Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you. Question. I'm wondering if your guest encounters people who are dying, who have fears about death, and whose family members may have had fear about death. And if so, how do they deal with that?
Thank you, Greg. Such an important question. I think that no matter how medically and technologically advanced we are, the fear of death is always there. It's always present. And so I've seen like a whole variety of flavors and what happens to patients in the last phase of life. Patients with, for example, and it's also quite specific to the disease that they have. Patients who have cancer and struggle with pain are worried about being in intractable pain. Patients who have lung disease are often worried about suffocation, right? They're worried. I've had patients say, I'm not worried about dying. I'm not afraid of dying, but I'm afraid of being suffocated to death in the last phase. Or I'm afraid that I will be in such pain that I won't be able to tolerate it, and I'll be crying, and I don't want my family to see me this way. Mm. I don't want my daughter or my daughter-in-law changing my, having to do my body care and changing my briefs, right? Mm. Those are all the fears that people have, other than just the fear of not existing anymore. So a lot of times what I've done is I'll just sit down and say, you know, what's the worst thing that you can think of? Let's talk about it now so that we make sure that it never happens. What's the worst? And then they'll tell you what it is. Okay, it's fear of suffocating. And then I say, okay, that's not going to happen, because we're going to make sure that we give you oxygen. We're going to give you this medication, this treatment. We are going to have the respiratory therapist work with us. We have an entire team working with us. we will just make sure that we mitigate it so much that it's practically not there. And again, the honesty is really important, right? Because if I'm saying pablum and I'm just giving false assurances to people, then they don't trust me, they don't believe it. So it is not that there is no cause to fear. It's just that we are here to work together and overcome the fear together, and you're not alone. You're not alone, and we will never abandon you. But great question. Thank you, Greg.
Yes, thank you so much, Greg. And if you have a question about end-of-life affairs, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Today, we're joined by Dr. Vijay Pericoil, founder of the Stanford Letter Project, which makes having discussions about end-of-life affairs a bit easier. They provide free letter templates in multiple languages, the What Matters Most letter, the Who Matters Most letter, and I Matter Too. You can find those letters and more about the project, kalw.org, click news, and then your call. Dr. Vijay Pericoil is professor of medicine at Stanford University and director of Stanford's Longevity, Equity, and Aging Research Consortium. We have an email from Bruce who says, humor is good. When my brother-in-law was suffering before he recently died after a long illness, he was frustrated by too many people coming by or calling. He wanted some solitude. When I asked him what he wanted written on his gravestone, he said, "Leave me alone." We had a good laugh, which helped ease his pain. Well, thank you for writing, Bruce, and I'm sorry to hear about your brother-in-law. You bring up a really good point. And Dr. Vijay, here's something else to think about. If your loved one is suffering from an illness, another good question is, do you want a lot of visitors? Do you want phone calls? I mean, these issues are just so important, and you don't know until you ask.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And some of us are introverts. Some of us are extroverts. And who people want at this very vulnerable time is entirely dependent on them, right? For example, someone might have like this persona of themselves, a professional persona, and they want people in their work circle to remember them that way, not laying in bed, wearing a hospital gown, or, you know, they've lost weight and they look cachectic. They don't want that, right? So it's entirely up to them. And this is why I said earlier, you can never get it wrong, meaning as the dying patient or as a family member, you can never get it wrong as long as you're earnest and you're trying, right? So whatever people want is what they want. In our unit, we usually ask people, you know, what is your preference for receiving information? Who would you like to have phone calls from? And not only that, I ask them, you know, when is it okay for me to come and round on you? Some people are night owls and they want me to come after 1 p.m. I don't go in at 5 in the morning or 7 in the morning and wake them up. So everybody has their own preference, and it's just a question of trying to better understand them and be respectful of their preferences, wow. Right? So I heard, I don't know how true this is, I heard that when Steve Jobs was in the last phase of his life, he had very specific people he wanted to talk to. He had a longer list of people he did not want to talk to. And it was his life, his choice, and you honor that. So I completely agree with that.
Well, thank you again for the email. We have another email from a listener who says, oftentimes people may carry a secret about their life. For example, having a child, giving it up for adoption, having a same-sex relationship or an affair. It's important that they decide if and how they want surviving family to learn this history, or if they want to destroy any information, letters, diaries, photos they have. That's an interesting one.
Yeah, I remember a situation where I'm sitting at the bedside of the patient and I'm working on pain and whatnot, and the patient decides to tell me, unprompted, deep, dark stories about their life and how this person had been a pedophile. Mm-hmm. And I'm sitting there like stone cold, not knowing what to do, not wow. exactly something that they prep you for in med school. So you're sitting there, and I was, of course, listening, active listening, because this person was experiencing profound regret and talking about it and was dying. But I could not be unauthentic and say, that's okay, or you will be forgiven, or anything like that. All I think I could do was just sit at the bedside and listen and not run away. When you feel like you want to run away, right? Mm. But you know, but sometimes just being there, and it takes a lot of grit to just stay at the bedside when you hear this sort of blood-curdling stories from people, you know, about crime or what they've done. Other stories I've heard are people where they abandoned their loved ones. I had a kid, and I just left the kid and never looked back, and she'll be like 48 right now, and I don't know what she's doing, that kind of stories. And this point about from the reader is so brilliant. When we all have our life stories hidden away in some place, right? In some drawer that we hope that nobody ever looks in. So we should be able to prepare for that and at least say, you know, do not open this, please incinerate. I don't want anybody to see it, right? And so I think that's a great point, and thank you for raising that, because that becomes part of what you want done for yourself as you get to the end. And wow. Then dealing with all that is just is not easy, not trivial.
Mm, that's Dr. Vijay, that's amazing. I mean, you're seeing a side of humanity that most of us might read about or see in a movie, but you're seeing it up close. How has that shaped you and the work that you do?
You know, that's a great question. And I think that my patients have tirelessly been chiseling me and continue to work on me so that I can be more helpful to the next patient I take care of. They've made me reflect on things that I personally wouldn't have had the courage to. For example, one patient's wife asked me to say the Hail Mary, ask her husband was dying. She's like, he never listens to anyone except his doctor. So I want him to go to the light. And so you say the Hail Mary. And there I am standing at the bedside, like frozen, thinking, what? Hail Mary? I don't remember the words. Wow. And this is like a pop quiz. So each patient is like a pop quiz, right? And medical training is great and all, but I think you learn a lot by just listening and from experience and from one patient. So I almost feel like I'm a butterfly, right? Learning from one patient and taking it to the other patient, because you don't get trained for this at med school. Surely not.
Right. Wow. I was thinking if we could all be so lucky to have such a compassionate doctor like you.
Oh, thank you. Very kind. You made my day. Thank you.
We have a couple other questions just about how do you even begin these conversations. And April 16th is National Healthcare Decision Day, and I understand that you're all going to host live letter writing groups to help people think about these issues in a gentle environment.
Yeah. So what the power of many is often understated or overlooked. When we have a whole bunch of people sitting in one place where there is clear rules, there is support, then people are able to at least take the first step. Okay, you come to the event and you don't write anything, you just go walk away with a blank paper, fine, so be it. Today you had a blank paper, yesterday you didn't even have that in your hand. So again, I would think about baby steps, and self-compassion is the most important thing. The very fact that you listen to even a bit of this program, the very fact you're thinking about it makes you're like so above and beyond most other people right now. So yeah, that's why we do that. We have the groups, and then we've conducted the groups in many languages, and we can talk more about if anyone wants to participate. We can definitely do that.
Yeah, we have just a few minutes left. How can people get involved?
What I can do is provide the information to you, if that is okay with you, Rose, and then we can tell you the time and place, and then people are welcome to come join us, and we'll have the templates, we'll have my team there, and then we can help people write the letters.
That sounds great. Thank you so much, Dr. Vijay. In our final moments, given the amazing work that you do, I just wonder what your thoughts are about policy changes, given that the United States population is now the oldest it's ever been. So many people are turning 65 every day in this country. And these people are going to need care. So this is a big question, of course. We could have you on for an entire hour in the future, and I would love for you to come back. But what changes would you like to see, given the fact that the population is really, the older population is exploding?
No, that's such an important question. And the way, given that we have like literally 2 minutes, I will just say that we should do aging by design and not serendipity. So people are living much longer nowadays, right? Medicines are so much more personalized with precision health and precision medicine. Treatments are so targeted to illnesses that people are going to end up living much longer than what their grandparents did. Mm-hmm. If you look at the Middle Ages, people dropped like flies when they were in their 40s, right? And look at us now. There are so many people in the blue zones who are 100 years and older. And then the question is, how can we get the most enjoyment out of every single day of life? For me, my personal goal for me is to live as long as I possibly can. And then, as one of my patients said, I want to wake up dead one day, right? Like, have no illness, have amazing functional status, and then wake up dead. But we do know that the data show that in the last 2 years of life, that is when people lose their ability to be independent, do things for themselves. And so I think every effort should be made towards figuring out how we can compress that morbidity. And that's a whole other talk. How can we have the most amount of health for the most number of days or years? And then when we die, it's a quick, painless process. Mm-hmm. What can we do towards that? I think that's where we really need innovation, and that's what should be the focus of what we do. Because selfishly, for me, when I die, I want all of this figured out so that I can die peacefully and gently after having lived a long and productive life where I've helped others. Mm.
Beautifully said. We'd love to have you back. Dr. Vijay Perry-Coyle is professor of medicine at Stanford University, director of Stanford's Longevity, Equity, and Aging Research Consortium, and founder of the Stanford Letter Project. Dr. Vijay, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Rose, and thank you to your brilliant listeners. I so enjoyed it, and I learned a lot. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you for joining us. It's your call. I'm Rose Aguilar.